Welcome to the first episode of Season 3 of the Directions on Microsoft Briefing podcast. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the Editor-in-Chief here at Directions. I'm your host for the series of podcasts for those interested in the Microsoft Enterprise IT ecosystem. The Directions on Microsoft Briefing brings you the best insights from the best independent Microsoft watching firm in the business, Directions on Microsoft. Directions has been focused on providing Microsoft IT planning and negotiation information since 1992. Today's podcast is all about data. I've got two of the Directions analysts as my special guests, both of whom are very passionate about all things data related. Barry Briggs worked at Microsoft for 12 years in a variety of roles, including CTO for Microsoft's own IT organization for 5 years. Prior to Microsoft, Barry spent several years as CTO for several successful startups, and before that, 11 years at Lotus Development, where he was the lead developer for Lotus 1-2-3 and a Lotus Fellow. Andrew Snodgrass was the vice president of IT for a global Fortune 500 company, where he directed overall IT activities and strategy for the company's global operations. After that, he started and sold a software firm specializing in combining and cleansing disparate data sources in large engineering companies. Hi, Barry. Hi, Andy. Thank you so much for doing this podcast today.
No problem.
Hi, Mary Jo.
All right, Barry. I'm going to pick on you first. As CTO for Microsoft's own IT organization, I'm guessing that managing Microsoft's data might have been pretty important. So tell us a few of your experiences around this.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, before I took over the CTO role, my first role in Microsoft IT was leading the development of Microsoft's internal master data management initiative somewhere in the 2008-ish timeframe. You know, there we built what I believe is still the world's largest customer MDM system. And why did we build that? Well, we built it because at Microsoft, we had a lot of business units and therefore a lot of IT applications that talk to customers. So, you know, different teams like Office and Windows and Xbox, SQL Server and so forth, and all these had their own marketing applications, therefore their own customer databases, and they were all talking to customers and sometimes the same ones. Well, then there came this law called canned spam that said, among other things, that everybody has to be able to unsubscribe from marketing emails with a single click. And by now, we're all used to that, right? We've all seen these emails, and at the bottom of the email says, click here to unsubscribe. But that actually turns out to be kind of hard if you have a lot of disconnected, separate apps all talking to customers. So what we had to do was build a single database with core customer information, contact preferences that all the applications could check. And so Microsoft has a lot of customers. You know, actually, we had several billion records in the application. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really big system, and keeping it up to date, keeping it manageable was a pretty big challenge. So for those of you who don't know what master data management really means, you know, it stores and maintains what we call reference data. So, you know, core authoritative information like, you know, things like customer's name, customer's address. If for commercial customers, other things like, you know, Dun & Bradstreet numbers and so forth. And it turns out to be really important if you want to send an email to, you know, pick a company like Boeing. Do you send it to, you know, local, you know, here in Washington State, or do you send it to their corporate headquarters in Chicago? And what happens when they move? And you have to keep track of all that kind of stuff. So the idea here was that transactional systems, like the CRM applications, the marketing applications, should rely on this central source of truth, this core information, and not have everyone do their own. And so that was sort of my introduction to, you know, data management at scale. And then when I took on the CTO role, this was, data management was at the enterprise scope was job one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Andy, you were a CIO. So how did you think about data while you were in that role, and what were your key concerns?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I always like listening to Barry talk, and we're good friends. And, mm-hmm. and his perspective comes from a completely different end of the spectrum than mine. I worked for engineering construction companies, and this was all about culture. And it was trying to get people just to do stuff at times, right? In our organization, we were all about project management. We had large engineering construction jobs that were all over the world. and data that could be accumulated on any of these things, if we could get the right insights and get the right reporting from it and actually get people to put all the data in, then we could know what was going well, we could find out what was going wrong, and we'd be able to fix everything on it. The big problem that we had in the organization was that these projects were so far removed from the corporate office that they were often out of the viewpoint and the concern of the executives that were there. And so people in the corporate office just took care of corporate stuff. And that's where all the IT money was being spent. It was being spent on these great big ERP and CRM systems and tax and HR and everything else. And they weren't really supporting all the projects that were out in the field, which seemed odd because that's where they made their money. And so as a CIO, my role was to switch that cultural perspective on systems and on data and make the projects the highlight of where we spent our money and our time, which we were able to do fairly well over a number of years. It was always compounded, though, as a real difficulty in the fact that the company kept being successful and growing, and they grew through acquisitions, which meant we were constantly looking at buying a new company that had a different data format and different systems in place, and how do we integrate them and how do we bring everything in and manage everything on it. And so as much as I would have liked to get to an MDM environment that Barry was tasked to do, we were lucky just to keep operating on a daily basis and make everybody participate in at least one organization. You know, so yeah, those are my big concerns on data.
Got it.
Yeah. Andy, I found that the whole mergers and acquisition thing is one of the biggest challenges in managing data, because you have these heterogeneous sources that have to somehow be reconciled in some way. We actually had a whole team of people that were focused just on managing M&A and the IT aspects of M&A.
Yeah. Did you ever go to a company that you acquired, arrive in the parking lot that morning in order to take a look at everything and have the people in the building lock the building and not let you in? There were some really aggressive acquisitions that we did where we were just locked out. Wow. It was bizarre. Yeah. There were, and so that's the extreme on a data silo perspective of things.
Definitely. Okay, I want to ask Barry about something I've heard him mention during our editorial meetings at Directions. I've heard him talk about the Briggs model of data. So I'm thinking this is named after you, probably. And I'm curious, what is it and how did you come up with it?
Yeah, well, so, you know, after we did that MDM app that I was talking about, you know, Microsoft IT embarked on its first at-scale data warehousing project around 2012, I guess, I think. And I began to realize that there was this four-layer model of relational data, somewhat analogous to the three-tier model of applications that everybody talked about at the time. You know, data layer, business logic layer, presentation. Everybody talked about it. Nobody did it. Well, same is true for data, except there was four layers. And so with a four-layer model, you have reference data at the bottom. You know, that's the data that's very rarely changes but is used by all the transactional applications, of which there are many, and the data changes frequently. And then all that data in the transactional apps flows upward to the single data warehouse, which is sort of like the grand central station of data, you know, star schema and all that kind of stuff. And then it's recombined and exported in interesting ways to specialized analytics systems like data marts and campaign applications and so on. So data pretty much always, you know, flows upwards in this model from the reference data to the transactional system to the warehouse to the marts. And so anyway, I hadn't seen anything quite like this in the literature. It was a Kimball model and the Inman model, but not quite like this. So I figured I invented it. And since I invented it, I could name it. And so I named it after myself, the Briggs model.
Do you know what's funny, Barry, is I've heard this and I've used it in everything I work on.
You know, the funny thing is it actually kind of became obsolete the day I came up with it, because it really only covered the relational stack, right? Yeah. And you're right, at that time, we're really on the cusp of the, you know, the Hadoop and big data and NoSQL and data lake and data lakehouse and all that kind of stuff, all those, you know, revolutions that happened thereafter.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to ask both of you about this because as somebody, I used to cover databases when I first started out as a reporter, and then things just kind of multiplied and got complex. We started hearing about data warehouse and data lake, then data lake warehouse, and then there was AWS Redshift and Azure Data Lake Storage and Databricks and Snowflake. So I'm like, wow, this just seems like a big mess. Is it, Andy?
Well, no, I don't think it's necessarily a big mess. I think that there was a move, like with Hadoop and a lot of those open source distributed parallel processing systems that came out, the idea of handling unstructured data and big data and all the rest of that, that were there for a specific reason. And they met this need of expanding data types, especially around things that we were seeing with all the web-based activities and social media and everything else. It kind of spurred on this concept of we need to be able to track a lot of unstructured data. Mm-hmm. But one of the problems that I found in it was people started realizing that you could use these systems for more than just gathering that kind of unstructured data. You know, if you take a look at the idea of a Hadoop cluster, and this is the ability to say, I'm going to put a bunch of data into this environment and I'm going to run queries against this data. And it might be of different types. It might be the same type. But I'm able to distribute the query processing across a bunch of equipment, all right, a bunch of hardware out there. And so you could get massive queries and massive amount of analysis done much faster than we ever could before and for a decent price. And so what we started to see people do was say, well, I've got this data warehouse. I'm going to throw that in Hadoop, and I'm going to run big queries on it and take a look at historical data and see if I can find some new insights. And who knows what's going to be discovered, right? There was this move to say, let's just put everything out there and see what we can find. And then that proliferated into data lakes and lake houses and all the rest of it. And what I find off of this is, there's this old adage that says, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Okay? Right. And we find that a lot of people set up data lakes because they were straightforward to do and they had the ability and started just throwing everything in it because who knows? You know, there might be something in there that's going to be the panacea to help us solve all of our problems. Mm. And what a lot of organizations wound up doing over time was they started creating data swamps, because it just had too much junk in it. Mm-hmm. And they were spending tons of money for things that they weren't getting any value from. And so it kind of goes back to what Barry originally talked about with MDM. If you're going to gather data, if you're going to put it into something like a data lake or a Redshift or even Databricks or Snowflake, right? You still have to think about what you're doing. You still have to say, what's going to be the value here? What is it we're trying to accomplish? And I think we're starting to get that kind of maturity. A lot of organizations have rigor and processes around it, so they don't just spend money willy-nilly. But there's still people out there that think, oh, I'm going to throw it into this system, and it's just going to magically give me all my answers. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. You still have to do the hard work to say, what is it we're trying to accomplish?
All right. I'm going to use this opportunity to take a quick break, so that we can talk a bit more about what we do here at Directions on Microsoft. First and foremost, in spite of our name, we are not affiliated with Microsoft. We provide product strategy and licensing information about Microsoft Enterprise products. Among the many services we offer are our regular Microsoft licensing boot camps to help customers new to licensing get up to speed and veterans refresh their knowledge about Microsoft licensing. Our next virtual boot camp is March 11th to 15th. And if you prefer an in-person experience, come to Atlanta May 21st to May 23rd, where we'll have an in-person boot camp. Whether virtual or in-person, these boot camps offer attendees the most up-to-date Microsoft licensing information out there. We also offer advisory services such as EA negotiation support and Microsoft strategy assessments, where we help you one-on-one with your specific Microsoft product questions and licensing issues. Go to directionsonmicrosoft.com or email info@directionsonmicrosoft.com to learn more about all of the services that we offer. Okay, back to the Barry and Andy Data Show.
Hey, before we get too far into this, you mentioned, this is good for the listeners, right? That sure. We're not related to Microsoft, but we have Microsoft in our name. And that's because we're that old before there was any kind of controls around it.
Right.
But if you look at, this will tickle the people, is if you look at our domain at directionsonmicrosoft.com. When Microsoft or Office 365 first came out, everything was .onmicrosoft.com.
Right.
And it drove them nuts that we actually had that in our domain name.
Oh, wow. I never even thought about that.
Yeah, it was fun. It gave us fits there for a couple of years, but we got it all worked out.
All right. I want Barry to kick things off on part two here with a little bit about data models. Barry, let's talk about that.
So, Andy, we haven't talked about, you know, to me, what is kind of the core of the core of the core of enterprise data management, which are data models, right? And I still think that rigorously defined data models, like what is your definition of a customer? What is your definition of a product? And so on, you know, I still think those are pretty important. And I also think, you know, the reason I think that they're important is at the end of the day, they kind of define, you know, your business model, at least reflect what your business model is. What do you think about that?
I think you're preaching to the choir. Yeah, as a data guy, to sit down and say that we're going to deploy some systems, create a database. If you don't know what your requirements are, what your model is, what your business processes are, what you're trying to accomplish, even down to the point of saying, we're going to have this data in this particular table and it's updated by this system and that's updated by these people because that's their business process to do and it can't be modified by these knuckleheads over here who think it's their business process. Yeah. So the whole idea of a data model, right, if we go all the way down to it, was let's define our business processes, let's map all this thing out, let's get agreement on it, and then overlay a data model onto those business processes so the data matches what it is we think we're trying to do. Absolutely.
I sort of feel like, you know, with all this whiz-bang new technology of, you know, business intelligence and big data and lake houses and where, you know, workspaces and all that kind of stuff, that that some of this core stuff has just kind of gotten forgotten.
Yeah, there's a balance off of it. I mean, if we look at suppose we were setting up a MongoDB database, right, or a collection, and we've got a nice document structure on it. One of the real benefits of that is that the schema is dynamic. Right. I can start off with whatever my collections, my tables need to be within this database. And if I need to add additional fields in one or take them out on another or change the structure, I don't have to change some high end schema that's then enforced and run some kind of update and upgrade on all of it. I can do this dynamically.
Yeah. But for some applications, you don't want that.
Well, yeah. But that's my thing on it is I think in a lot of situations, it makes people a bit lazy because they figure, all right, we're going to start off with this and we don't have to think more than 6 months in advance because we know what we're doing right now. The schema is adjustable. So we'll worry about that 6 months down the road if something comes. And it's got to be a balance in there of saying we can and can't do this type of thing.
Okay. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little and let's do a quick lightning round kind of debate about relational data and Microsoft. First, do you guys think relational databases, and in particular SQL Server, are one, already dead, two, dying, or three, neither?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, you know, with the advent of, you know, really cheap, scalable storage in the cloud, you know, as we talked about, there are lots of ways to managing data, and we can manage different types and formats in ways that are appropriate for them. So, you know, you normally don't put, you know, for example, media into SQL Server. You can, but you know, there are better ways to do it, perhaps.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in terms of, you know, relational going away, you know, when I think about that, I think, you know, there's still companies that are running IMS for crying out loud, you know, but, you know, for more seriously, you know, for things like financials, you know, where you have, you know, regulatory reporting requirements, you want the highest possible levels of integrity. You want ACID transactions. You want multi-phase commits. You want disaster recovery. You want backup. You know, all the benefits that relational databases, and in particular SQL Server, have had for decades. And you always will.
Yeah. No, you know, and I agree with you entirely on that, Barry. It is interesting, I find, that so many different types of databases now are trying to implement that type of control. You know, you and I were talking about the Mongo stuff that's in Cosmos DB the other day. And there's this new vCore deployment, and they're talking about how it gives multi-document ACID controls. And what it really does is a multi-pass document consistency, right? It doesn't give that full atomosity and controls that you would normally have in a SQL Server database environment. But I'm seeing a lot of tools now try to come out and claim to have relational database controls on top of them as a way of saying, we want your SQL Server related data. And it's not the same thing. It's not that same level of saying that I've got this centralized relational database engine like SQL Server or Postgres or whichever one you want to pick, and that nothing can touch the data, nothing can query it, nothing can do anything with the data without going through that database engine. And what I find with a lot of other things like data lakes and the rest that are coming out, they're putting relational models over the top of unstructured or even structured related stuff that's down below. But there's multiple ways of getting to the data. You don't always have to go through the relational model that sits on top through the Delta Lake or any of the rest. You can go at it sideways. And that violates the integrity that Barry's talking about. And I think that's a risk to organizations because they don't always see. They see the potential of this being a one-for-all type thing, and they don't see that it's, you know, violating some of the rules that you actually want a relational database to manage for you.
Mm-hmm. There's another angle to this too, which is, you know, if you know when you're designing an application in enterprise IT, for example, suddenly you now have this enormous variety of data management systems and services that you can choose from, right? So, you know, if I'm building an application, should I use SQL Server and, by the way, pay the associated licensing fees? Or am I okay using MySQL or Postgres or another open source system? Do I just go right to, you know, some other Mongo or Cosmos DB or something like that? And, you know, so, you know, what that comes out to be is not only is it a technical decision, but it's also a governance decision because, you know, any enterprise IT department wants to have a limited subset of those that are standardized and that are supported by the IT support organizations.
Exactly. And one of the things I think, Mary Jo, that we're seeing recently, Barry and I were walking through this idea on it, was that I don't think SQL Server is in danger, mm-hmm. per se. And, you know, we covered directions, we covered all the Microsoft stuff, so let's talk about that one. I don't think it's necessarily in danger. I think it has a strong user base, and mm-hmm. there's so many applications out there using it. I think it's solid on its future, and they're still progressing the system and everything on it. But it is taking a hit by a couple of changes that I think have happened recently. One is, over the past few years, more organizations have become comfortable with open source. You know, you go back 5-10 years, there was, you know, the diehard saying, nope, never doing open source, unsupported, can't do this, can't do it, won't do it. And now you're seeing a lot of people take it on to the point where Postgres is now becoming the fastest growing relational database rather than SQL Server, because people are comfortable with the idea of, we're going to go with Postgres, even though it is open source, we trust it. The other one is, I think Microsoft is spending too much time making SQL Server work with Azure. And what we saw recently was SQL Server 2022 came out, and it had been 3 years since the last version. And what they did in that 3 years was primarily focused on making SQL Server work with Azure capability. So it could do backup, it could do failover, it could do all kinds of things back and forth with Azure SQL related services, even down to using Azure AD or Entra ID, that's called now, for user authentication. Now, these were all good things, but what they didn't do in that 3 years was really progress the security and performance of the core database engine. That's what Postgres was doing, and that's why they caught up. So now I think it's more of a head-to-head race, and I think they're still going to be okay, but I think they damaged their potential there by doing that. What do you think, Barry?
Well, it's a trade-off, right? You know, my sense is that if you look at, you know, where Microsoft and for that matter, all the big companies, where are they spending their innovation dollars? It's all about the cloud. You don't see any innovation happening on premises anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, I sort of understand where they're going, but I think your points are right too, because there's a lot of by focusing so much on that, and we'll talk about AI as well, which is the new brass ring that everybody's mm-hmm. jumping on to. They may be missing some of the nuts and bolts stuff that people really need.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know how much of a lightning round that was, MJ.
I know. Well, now I'm going to throw another monkey wrench in here. What about Fabric, right? Microsoft Fabric, the unified cloud-based analytics platform. Does that solve anything in terms of, unifying Microsoft's products and strategy, or is it just adding one more layer of complexity on top?
Oh, I was hoping you were going to give me a yes-no response on that. Now I have to actually explain it. So does it solve a problem? I think it solves a wonderful problem. If what you were doing was using multiple Synapse Analytics and Data Factory components, and even Power BI, and you had deployed these all separately and you wanted to tie them together, and you basically had to tie all these things manually together, and you had to pay for each one separately. And if data needed to be shared, a lot of times it had to be copied, or you had to have a central data location and give people access to that same location. And so from a deployment, from a sharing side of things, and from a payment side of things, I think Fabric's a really cool tool. It solved a lot of the administrative headaches and collaboration related efforts that were out there. As for a data solution, I'm not holding my breath on this yet. Hey, the big thing in the data solution that they're putting forward is this thing called OneLake. Okay, and for those who don't know, what OneLake is an abstraction layer that sits over the top of the existing Azure Data Lake storage solution. And what you would have to do before is for each one of these services you set up and each one of these workspaces you set up in different parts around the world and for different departments, you always created a separate Azure Data Lake storage account to throw your data into. And that's where you would work with things if you were working in Azure Data Lake. And what OneLake does is it puts an abstraction over the top of it so that it automatically deploys those storage accounts for you, but then it makes it look like they're all part of one big data lake. So you don't have to log in to each one of them separately if you're working on different workloads. So again, productivity thing, that thing works out quite nicely. Where I think it struggles is they're putting forth the idea of a data warehouse solution in this. And this is supposed to be a replacement for the Azure SQL data warehouse solution that they already have in Synapse. Well, in this new solution in OneLake for data warehouse, they are not using the SQL Server database engine. Okay. They are using their own database management control and through Apache SQL over the top of it. All right. So it's very standard generic SQL. It doesn't match SQL Server's T-SQL language. There's lots of differences there. There's different data types, there's different query types, different commands. Not hugely, but there are enough that you can't just say move it over and make it magically work. But the other problem I have with it is that they, on top of this, they said we're going to throw a Delta layer to give it relational control and schema control and everything else on it. But it doesn't actually control the data itself. It's just an indexing schema layer that sits over the top of it. So the raw data still sits behind it. And if you have rights, you can go to the raw data. You can bypass all the security controls set on the data warehouse or on the lakehouse and go straight into the data on the back end. I get antsy when things like that happen with my data. I want to make sure that nobody can touch it without going through the right protocols. And so from my perspective, I think Fabric's got a few years, and I'm talking 2 or 3 years of maturity before I would feel comfortable putting real production data warehouse related stuff in there. Now, some of the other stuff I don't have a problem with. I think it's really cool, but the data warehouse bugs me.
Well, you know what bugs me is that when I look at the kind of the overall Microsoft enterprise data picture, it's getting, I won't say hopelessly, but it's getting really complicated. And I think about, Fabric and SQL pools and SQL engines and data lake and one lake and so forth and so on. It feels like there's one layer of abstraction on top of another layer of abstraction. And I think there's, you know, there's this effort to kind of keep things compatible, but move things into the new world. And it's getting really complicated. So, you know, I think that's kind of the appeal of, you know, third-party offerings like Snowflake and maybe Databricks as well. You know, it says, you know, what you really need to do is not, you know, fix up the Model T and put a V8 in it, but rather go to something that's wholly new, wholly architected for the cloud, and has separate compute, you know, separates compute from the data, you know, has zero maintenance, supports all the kind of cloud things that you want to support, like scale out and so forth and so on. So, you know, and this is what I hear from, you know, customers as well, that, you know, there's this tension between the complexity of compatibility and the appeal of the new thing. And, you know, I'm not sure quite what the right answer is. Probably depends on kind of, you know, what your enterprise requirements are. But you know, I do see this complexity as being a blocker for a lot of customers.
Oh, I do too. And, you know, one of the real challenges that we always see with these type of systems, right, is I think Snowflake's got a great future on it. And I love their clean approach they took. So we're going to make cloud system. This is the way it is. And then I think back on my days in the way that my organization worked. And it's like, well, if we can't have a local database, we really can't do this because we're actually working at a mine site in Peru that right. has no connectivity, right. right? And so there's all these different requirements. And I don't know a lot of manufacturing organizations that say, well, I need a local database beside my equipment because we're doing performance analysis and we've got our own machine learning models and everything already running on it. And so I think it can be part of an overall picture, and I think it can be a destination for data and the way applications work. Again, it's always going to be this situation of, does it meet our business need? Does it tie in with the applications that we have? And is it going to give us the return that's worth our investment in moving away from what we have and refactoring and putting it into something better? And I think that's the hard sell is, do we have the time and the people and the money to change what we're doing to make it better? And will that betterment, betterness, whatever we want to call it, is it going to be enough to justify the amount of effort we just put into it? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's going to depend.
I think that's a great point. And just to, you know, build on that a little bit, this stuff is, you know, there's, you know, the licensing fees and so forth that are associated with that technology, whatever service you choose, you know, is one thing. But the effort, the enterprise effort that gets put into building these types of things is enormous. You know, so I usually figure, you know, 10 to 100x maybe of, you know, in terms of labor, in terms of, you know, figuring out the ETLs and whatever other data transfer mechanism you're using and so forth. It's, you know, it's a big investment and it's a big undertaking. And what you want to avoid is, at all costs, is, I remember what one analyst, not from Directions, told me one time, a long time ago, is that, you know, data warehouses are where data goes to die.
And they did.
That's what you don't want.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they used to do, right? We always used to say it's a point of record, right? And we would put all the data out there, and after a couple of years, nobody analyzed the historical stuff, and so you put it in cold storage. Yeah.
And after you just spent $50 million to get it in there, you know, you're kind of going, where's my ROI on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
No, I agree.
All right, guys, I don't want to break up the Geek Fest here, but I got to ask you this question because I'm a journalist at heart, and I always want to know what's next, right? So what's next for enterprise data management? And you know what we haven't talked about yet? I bet somebody's going to talk about AI here, right? Like, we've mentioned it in passing, but we haven't really focused on it.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's absolutely true. And it's a good thing you mentioned it, because every podcast has to mention AI.
It does. You can't have a podcast without the word
Co-pilot. It's a requirement.
It's not allowed.
But you know what? I just pulled up
Co-pilot and it said we need to ask it about Co-pilot.
See?
Yeah. See, but what I'm hearing is that, you know, the big consulting companies love AI because you have to prepare your data for it, right? So, you know, one of the things that they tell you, and they just, Microsoft says this like it's really easy, is, you know, just make sure that all your data is properly protected and all the rights management is set up and all the permissions are set up properly and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, yeah, that's a good idea, because you don't want somebody in, you know, Copilot asking a question and getting back confidential information that they're not supposed to see, except, you know, you go into the details. That's really hard to do all that. That's all. That can be an enormous, enormous undertaking to get all your data ready for Copilot.
Yeah, and it's true for any AI-related thing. We're seeing that there's a huge lack of concern, or maybe people are starting to be concerned about it, around data governance in this world of AI and discovery. You know, the idea that you have a service or a system in your environment that is able to see everything that you should have access to. One, that's a bit alarming, okay? But from the standpoint of saying it's a productivity tool, right? If you think about this, Copilot is able to analyze everything that I'm working on. It can see everything that I have access to and everything I have rights to. What's interesting on it is it can see things that I have rights to that I didn't know I had rights to. Okay, so maybe in our SharePoint environment, there are certain SharePoint sites or certain documents and folders that are out there that somebody hasn't secured properly. I didn't know I had access to them. I would never go looking for them. It's not something that was an issue for me, but exactly. All of a sudden Copilot knows, and it's showing me the stuff that I didn't know that I didn't know.
I heard a Microsoft employee actually say this, that he said, don't give Copilot to your SharePoint admin. You know, SharePoint admin has rights for everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and your whole security team on it. And so I think there's a big concern. There's going to be information that gets leaked within an organization. There's going to be lawsuits that are following in on this. There's going to be exposure of data and information that shouldn't be. And I would doubt that most organizations are fully protected from themselves in letting loose an AI like that onto their environment.
Which brings me to the blog post that we're about to publish, Mary Jo, on very exactly this topic. So go to directionsonmicrosoft.com/blog tomorrow, and it will be there.
But, you know, to bring this discussion full circle, we started out talking about MDM, and none of what we're talking about now has anything to do with that, right? We didn't solve that problem, did we?
well, yes and no. I mean, part of MDM, if you're set up with all your data models correctly and managing your data properly, then you know where everything is and what's all exposed.
True.
Yeah. Okay. But again,
the problem with MDM really, and you know, it's absolutely essential for organizations, but it in and of itself has no direct business value. And so, you know, organizations are always fighting the battle of, I need to get this application out tomorrow, and I need to make my data ecosystem, you know, better and more accurate and have more integrity with an MDM system that's going to take resource and money and so forth. And so that's always kind of this trade-off between the near-term requirements of the organization and, you know, much longer-term requirements of ecosystem health.
Yeah, and a lot of times it was like trying to buy insurance, you know, justify insurance. Well, we didn't want to spend the money for MDM until something goes wrong. And then why didn't we have this organized properly? Well, because you wouldn't spend the money for MDM. Yeah. Oh.
Wish I thought of that analogy back in the day.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. This was a really fun conversation, and I'm glad I got to be part of it.
It was always delightful.
Always fun.
To close, I want to remind our listeners they can find lots more coverage of all things Microsoft related on directionsonmicrosoft.com. Thank you for listening. If you have questions, comments, or any topics that you'd like to hear the directions analysts cover in one of these podcasts, please do not hesitate to contact me on Twitter or X at Mary Jo Foley. And speaking of Twitter, give us a follow at DirectionsMSFT for all the latest Microsoft Enterprise product and licensing information. Thank you again.